And here we are for hour number two. Back on the Now program today, Tuesday, February the 12th, 2019. And today, this hour, we are going to have a lot of fun. I'm going to tell you why in just a moment. Do want to remind everybody that coming up tomorrow on the program, 1:10 to 2 p.m., we're going to be joined by legendary actor, famous for his roles in movies like The Jerk and Analyze This, probably most well known for his role as Walter Finley in the hit TV series Maude, Bill Macy, tomorrow, 1:10 to 2 o'clock. And then coming up on Thursday for 2 hours, 40th Treasurer of the United States under President Bill Clinton, Mary Ellen Withrow. Also, don't forget, Friday, March the 1st, we will be going to the most famous hot dog restaurant on planet Earth, Tony Paco's, in Toledo, Ohio. We will broadcast live from there from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m. Mary Ellen Withrow will be with us. Why will Mary Ellen be with us? Well, here's why. March 1st, 2019 is 25 years to the day that she was sworn in as Treasurer of the United States. So, on March 1st, 2019, we will all be at Tony Paco's, Charlie Evers, Terry Tackett, Sean Kraft, and myself, along with Mary Ellen, and we will all take part in a big ceremony because Tony Paco's is famous for having celebrities, well-known people, politicians, sign hot dog buns that will be displayed on the walls of Tony Paco's forever. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan is there, Burt Reynolds is there, Mr. T is there, Jamie Farr, a whole host of other people. And on that day, Mary Ellen Withrow will sign the hot dog bun during our broadcast. And it's kind of interesting because Mary Ellen Withrow is in the Guinness Book of World Records for signing more currency than any other person in the history of the United States. Now, I guess world. History of the World, Guinness Book of World Records. Now, don't forget, Tony Paco's opens at 10:30 on Friday mornings. We'll start broadcasting 11:15, but if you want to come join us, 1902 Front Street, Toledo, Ohio, 43605. Now, why is today a special day? We've got a first-time visitor, well, actually, second-time visitor to this program, but it's been, oh my God, 11 years since he's been on the program. And he's one of my favorite people for this reason. He was a part of one of my favorite television series. Why is it not on DVD? Why don't I see it on television anymore? That is a shame. I speak of Empty Nest, which ran for 7 years from 1988 until 1995. Richard Mulligan was the star. The person who joins us today played Charlie Dietz for all 7 years. You might remember him as Joe Isuzu, or possibly from the Airplane movies, Hare Krishna. It's going to be fun to talk with David, reminisce about Empty Nest and that great cast and all the guest stars who were on there. But before we do, they had one of the best theme songs of all time. Maybe some stories of Dreyfus the dog. We'll hear about that too. But do you remember Empty Nest?
Life goes on, and so do we. Just how we do it is no mystery. One by one, we fill the days. We find a thousand different ways. Sometimes the answer can be hard to find. That's something I will never be. I'm always here for anything you need. Rain or shine, to share it all as life goes on. We share it all as life goes on.
Oh, how I miss that show. We are so proud to welcome to these microphones David Leisure. David, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you so much. I didn't get to hear the music yet. I'm assuming you were playing Billy Vera and the Beaters.
Oh, David, start right off the bat. This will be a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And by the way, just a point of fact, I have a Mary Ellen Withrow's signature on a dollar bill somewhere. I don't know where I put it, but I know I have it somewhere.
Well, David, if you want to fly in on March the 1st to be a part of us, I'm sure they'd like to sign a hot dog bun up in Toledo.
Hey, I'm trying to figure out, is that hot dog bun have the life expectancy of a Twinkie? Because how do they keep it, you know, fresh with the signature?
You know, that is very interesting. All I know about it is that these are on the wall. I don't know if it's airtight, but I know Burt Reynolds started the tradition when the owner, Tony Paco, wanted his autograph, and Burt autographed a hot dog bun for some reason.
That's fantastic. I love that story.
it's going to be a lot of fun on March the 1st. Mary Ellen's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. I remember her. She came on our set. That's how come I got one.
Oh,
I understand why there's so much currency floating around with her. Of course, her name is on the money, and then, of course, then she signs it, then it becomes it's an item.
Absolutely. Now, David, I want to start with this. Empty Nest, I love it. It's a funny show, had a good long run, 7 years. Why is it not in repeats? Why has there been no DVDs? Has anybody explained this to you?
Well, it did play for a while. It was on, some sort of strange channel somewhere, and every once in a while I get a residual check, and they played all the episodes here in the States, and I'm not sure where they were playing, but they were on for a while. But I don't know why. It was a great show. It was a certain genre time period. Of course, we were so fortunate to be in the same stable as the Golden Girls. And they were our lead-in show, and they were the number one show at the time. So we got our good kickoff.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Richard Mulligan no longer with us. What was it like to work with him?
Richard was a genius. He was a genius. Every year, we get a new set of writers every couple, 3 years. And every time they would try to get him to be Bert from Soap. And he would never, ever compromise Harry Weston, his character on Empty Nest. Except right towards the end of the show, 7th season, they ran out of stuff. And we still were 2 minutes short. He says, I'll fill 90 seconds of that 2 minutes. And you won't have to write me anything. It'll be at the top of the show. I'm only going to do it once. So this is what a comic genius he was. He made coffee and toast for 90 seconds, and it was the funniest thing in the show. I mean, it was so Chaplin-esque, right? It was like the toast popped up, he caught it in the plate, he went, huh? And he did it like Bert would have done it on Soap. So he was really an amazing guy. Also, he was the captain of our ship. The coffee table, the desk in the set, he was there before everybody else got there working on the script. He was up there. I mean, it was like his office. Yeah, first season out, he won an Emmy. Everybody was so happy to see Richard back on television. He won an Emmy that year. He was nominated for a Golden Globe. I think Ted Danson won it that year. But Richard did win the Emmy, and that kicked us off really well.
That show went on right after Golden Girls, Saturday night at 9:30. Not all shows that were in that spot were a success. What do you think it was about Empty Nest that made it a success?
You know, they called us a spinoff of the Golden Girls. Basically, our pilot was 15 minutes, or actually 13 minutes, inserted into a Golden Girls episode. And it wasn't Richard Mulligan, and it wasn't me. Well, it was me. I was in it. But everybody else got replaced. And I think it was because it was almost like a continuation of the Golden Girls. I think it was like part of a family, part of a genre of what the Golden Girls were, that feeling that you had, that easygoing, no-brainer Saturday night that's easy to watch, entertainment.
And it was funny. It was a funny show.
It was a very funny show. We had great writers. I'm still best friends with some of them.
Well, David, it is interesting. There is a Golden Girls episode that sold in the syndication package that you kind of see. I mean, I think it's even the same set, the living room and the kitchen for Empty Nest, but I think it's Rita Moreno and another actor.
Hopefully.
You're the only one who made it to the series. How did that whole process happen?
Well, you know, when we shot the pilot, it was Rita Moreno, Paul Giuliani, and Jeffrey Lewis, Juliette Lewis's father, who was a great character actor, been in a million things. And his character had the best, the all-time gimmick of all gimmick character things. He had multiple personalities, so when he left the room, he came back as somebody else. So it's like a gag, you know, it's a gimmick.
I remember
and
that.
So when we shot this thing, and I said, there's not a chance in hell that this is ever going to make it. So I didn't even think about it. And then suddenly we come back, and it's a whole new cast. We got Christy McNichol, Dinah Manoff. We got Park Overall, and of course Richard Mulligan is the star. And so about the third year of the show, I was walking across the set, and I remember succinctly, I was in the middle of the set, and it was early in the morning, I was walking across the set, and I stopped cold in my tracks, and I went, well, I'm the luckiest son of a gun that ever walked, because out of all those wonderful people that were on the pilot, they kept me, the next-door neighbor guy? I was a very fortunate person.
Absolutely. Let's run down some of this cast. We did Richard Mulligan, but the cast, even throughout its changes over the 7 years, I don't think there was a dud in the bunch. Dinah Manoff, who also all 7 years, what was she like to work with?
Dinah was a consummate professional. She always tried to make everything she did look organic, and she worked so hard on it. And Hal Cooper was the original writer-producer, the showrunner, and he also directed the show. So the very first few shows, she gave herself so much business to look organic, she couldn't get the lines out. So by the third time, she messed up again, and she says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I just want to do this so badly." And Hal Cooper, as like the voice of Cecil B. DeMille coming out over the loudspeaker, says, "Well, so far you have."
She's a tremendous actress. I mean, a lot of people remember her from Grease.
Grease, so, you know, exactly. Just, you got to be in showbiz. I mean, she's, and by the way, she's a thoroughbred. She comes from, you know, Lee Grant is her mother, and she's, you know, her whole heritage is in the theater and TV and movies.
And I think the only other person in the cast who made the entire seven-year run, aside from Richard Mulligan, Dinah Manoff, and yourself, was Park Overall, the nurse, Laverne.
Park. Yeah, Laverne. She's a red-hot chili pepper. She really is. She's pretty much as sassy as she was as her character was.
You know, I saw her do a biography. There was a biography on her where she said that she didn't get along so well with Richard and Christy and Dinah, that there was not anger, but that they just had different ideas.
Well, I mean, you know, there's always going to be some sort of friction on the set. Mulligan and me and Bobby and Victor, we would play hearts while the girls were arguing about hair color. Now, I don't mean to make that sound sexist, but it was an important thing, because if somebody had a henna that was similar to somebody else's, then it was too much of the same thing, and everybody had to sort of adjust their hair color, so they had to take turns about who was going to look like when.
Well, what a problem to have on the set.
I know, it's a first world problem.
In 1992, there was a lot of news around Empty Nest. Christy McNichol started the season, but then had to depart about three or four episodes in that season. What happened, right, and how did that affect the show?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. I got to tell you, that is a wonderful question. So, Christy, you know, she was at one time the youngest Emmy Award winner of all times from her show Family. And she had the best instincts of anybody I've ever seen. And she did more with less. And so I remember we had a guest director on once who was watching her, and he said he got into her grill and said, "You missed all the comic beats." And she goes, "Well, where were you looking?" I said, "I'm standing right here in front of you." I said, "Did you see it on the monitor?" He said, "No." "So go back and look at the take." He went back and looked at the take, and she was right and he was wrong, because she nailed every single thing. It was just subtle enough for the camera, but not big enough for like a stage. And so she worked really, really hard. She, you know, she'd been working a long time. I think she just got a little burned out, you know. I mean, seriously. And the odd part was, this is a great story. When she left the show, we tried to fill that gap. And you know, there's a chemistry with actors and actresses, and when it works, man, it works. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. They resurrected a daughter that they only talked about. They brought in a husband for Dinah. They brought in Marcia Warfield. I mean, they kept trying to fill this empty spot that Christy used to fill. And then, for the last two episodes, she came back and was on the set, and it was like she never left. And there was a quiet moment where Victor, he was our set guy, he says, and there's nobody's talking, and you know, we're shooting the final episode of the whole series. And he says, "So, Christy, where have you been?" And it was like, "Where have you been? Because this is so good now." And everybody started crying, because it was. It was so good to have her back. And everything, all of a sudden, all the pieces fit back together again. It was really amazing. It was a moment that I'll never forget.
We can't play it in hindsight, but do you think had she not left that the show would have done better those last few years?
We did pretty good. You know, the fact that we stayed on network TV for 7 years was pretty amazing. It was tough to get the final back 2 years, but, I mean, you know, it's what it was. We did the best we could.
Well, you know, it was interesting, because as I remember the series, that 92, I think the fifth year, when she did leave, it was kind of strange, because here came this daughter who we didn't know, and Carol got a boyfriend. But the last 2 years, I kind of liked, because it changed a little bit, you know. Harry went to work at the community center. Marcia Wharf, Estelle Getty, you can't go wrong there. So it was still a good show.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but look how much stuff they brought in. I mean, yeah. They brought in Estelle. I mean, Estelle, and of course Estelle was, I mean, she's so funny. Estelle was great. She, you know her character? She goes like, "Dorothy," right? And she looks out like out in space, and she says her line, and she kills with it, right? So Estelle would nail everything at the table, when we had our reading. It was, like, funny. And as the week went on, she got worse and worse and worse. So we had these enormous cue cards with, I mean, huge, like a billboard-sized cue card with her lines on it. So her character actually was, you know, she was just reading that card that was out in space and saying her line. And but she nailed it. So who cares?
That's a great story, because I think that's one of the last things, certainly the last television series that Estelle was a part of, and it was
that's exactly right.
It was great. And one of the things in those last 2 years, it seemed like Charlie, your character, was pinned with Sophia, Estelle Getty, a lot of the time.
Oh, sure, yeah, we're two oddballs, you know. My job, basically, was to make weird and not comprehensible things work. And so every once in a while, the writers would come up and say, gosh, we're so sorry, the storyline is a little weak, and we don't know, you know, what to do. And so I can say, don't worry about it, I got it. Because my job was to make stuff that didn't work, work. Because I kind of come from the Larry Storch school of of acting. Bigger, better. You know, don't worry about it. I'll make it so big people think it's supposed to be funny. So don't worry about it. I got this.
It was great. Marcia Warfield, what was she like to work with?
Marcia's great. I love Marcia. Oh, my God. You know, so she used to have a talk show before she came on the show. We knew each other from comedy and stuff like that. So when she had a talk show, I was on the talk show. And I'm basically just a tight-ass white guy. So she's got MC Hammer on the show, right, when he was as hot as it gets. I had no idea who he was, right? Audience went crazy. He did the dance moves and the whole thing. I said, hey, this guy's really interesting. I mean, what does he do? He's a rapper. Marcia looked at me like, you're the dumbest white guy I've ever known. And she was right.
That's funny. Was it a happy set?
Yeah. For the most part, it's a happy set. I mean, we had our moments when things kind of went crazy, you know. I mean, I went through a divorce. Richard went through a divorce. Somebody went through a death. Somebody, you know, there was drama on the set. And then your family, right? So as a family, you go through this stuff where you guys get mad at each other and then you forgive each other. It's just like every family you ever have. There's stuff that goes on.
You know? And, of course, Dreyfus the dog.
Oh, Dreyfus. What a sweetheart. What a big red love bucket. He was the best. He was so cool. I remember once it was Dreyfus's birthday. And so they're doing a photo shoot. So they made him a birthday cake out of hamburger. So I'm with Dreyfus, and I'm supposed to be holding him this piece of cake in front of him and then have my arm wrapped around him, and they're doing this photo shoot. So the photographers are shooting, you know, they're shooting like 45 minutes. Well, this whole time, Dreyfus is looking at this piece of hamburger I'm holding. He's just drool is cascading out of his mouth, coming down my arm. There was a pool of dog saliva at the bottom of this thing for like 45 minutes. It was one of the grossest things in the world.
Was it easy in front of a studio audience for him to pull off what he pulled off?
Oh, Dreyfus?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had the best. Joel was the best dog trainer in the world. And that eyebrow thing that he used to do. What you do is you have one guy on one side and one guy on the other side of the set. So you tell him to stay still, and then the other guy would hold up a treat, and he'd look over there. And then the other guy would hold up a treat and look over there. So his eyebrows would go up and down and up and down. It was a great fit.
Oh, that's fun. Was it hard to do that show in front of a studio audience? Did you like having the audience there?
Loved it. Loved it to death. It gives you a different chemistry because we do two shows. We do a 5 o'clock show where we just run through the whole show and no stopping. So then you get to see where the beats are working, the comedy's working. Then we go have dinner, and then they give you brand new pages because the writers are going, that's not working, so let's rewrite something. So you get brand new stuff, and the first time you see it, it's like an hour before you go out there in front of the audience. And so then, but the audience gives you an energy that you normally don't get when there's no audience. Now, remember Fran Drescher?
Oh, yeah.
Right? From The Nanny, right? Okay, so she didn't have an audience. She had professional laughers. She would have 50 people hired to laugh. They weren't an audience, and they sat there for hours and hours and hours and laughed on cue for her show.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, the first time I sat in on one of those things, I was like, this is very bizarre. This is This is futuristically scary.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I'm picturing this now, because I haven't heard these stories before, that here's a live studio audience, the entire Empty Nest cast, which is great. You had Dreyfuss's trainers and Estelle Getty's cue card guys. That seemed like it could get difficult.
Well, it's kind of like a circus, you know. And you would think it'd be more glamorous than this, but we'd have, you know, 2x4s with a piece of cloth, and that was our dressing room. And we'd just go back there, and they'd throw the cloth over it, and then you change your clothes and come out of this, you know. It's so much like live theater, because like in live theater, you're off in the wings, and you don't have time to go to your dressing room to change. You just change right there. You just get naked, put on the other clothes, and come back out, you know. And this is pretty much... And TV shows is pretty much like live theater, you know, back in that day, you know, when they're, but I mean, it's still kind of like that too. You do get to do it over again if it wasn't working right, or if you missed a beat or somebody blew a line. So you get to take it over. That's a cool part about camera work. You get a second and third chances.
Now with Estelle Getty, her nailing it at the table read and then by the end of the week having to use cue cards, did she have any reason, attribute to why that was happening?
Yeah, she was old. I mean, come on, let's face it. I walk into a room sometimes and I forget why I'm in there, right? And then later my wife comes in there and goes, "What are you doing?" I try to fake her out, you know, and I say, I'm thinking. She says, "No, you forgot why you came in here, right?" I go, yeah, I did. I forgot why I walked in the room. So how long have you been there? I said, "I don't know, but I think I'm hungry."
There are two great moments in Empty Nest history that I remember. At the height of his popularity, Garth Brooks comes on Empty Nest.
Oh. Woo!
What was that like? What was that like?
That was sort of like, just get out of the way, right? Just get out of the way and let Garth Brooks be on the show. It was like, I think I had three lines and they cut it down to two. And it was like, just, you got the hottest guy in country music, or music period at the time, on our show. So everybody just get out of the way and let Garth Brooks be on the show. Okay, so, for example, Will and Grace, which is an excellent show, in their heyday, the first running of it, not this one, but they had guest stars on it all the time. I mean, it was almost like the old days of when Lucy and Desi go to Hollywood. You know, they always had William Holden or John Wayne or somebody on the show. And so having, at that time, nobody was doing stunt casting like this. And so we had this superstar on our show. And it was all through connections. And so it was like, it was a big deal. It was a very big deal.
It was a great show. And I was able to pull it up on YouTube the other night. And one of the most interesting things is at the end, the cast is sitting there, and they showed it during the credits, and Garth was doing a sing-along with the audience and the cast.
I got friends in low places.
You got it. You know, and I kept thinking, does Richard Mulligan really listen to Garth Brooks? Is this up his alley?
No, he's Etta James all the way.
Another seminal moment in Empty Nest history, and it ended up being his last television appearance, Danny Thomas.
Oh, my gosh, you did your homework. That's right. Yeah. He was, I mean, you know, and, you know, of course, Tony, his son, my friend, our producer, our boss, but also he's the greatest guy in the world. And so he would... You know, his dad would be going off, and they were trying to do some work, and Tony would be off set going, "Dad, Dad, Dad, Dad." And we'd all start laughing because he's trying to get his dad, because his dad would start doing, you know, stand up. And he'd go, "Dad, we gotta go, we gotta work, Dad." And he passed away very shortly.
Yeah.
Which was very sad.
Very shortly. 6 months or something like that. And somebody else who made their last appearance on Empty Nest, I believe, was Audrey Meadows.
Yeah. Audrey Meadows. Yeah, you know, I think about all the cool people that came on our show. And I go, like, you know, that I grew up watching. And it had a lot to do with Whit Thomas Harris, Susan Harris, Paul Witt, who recently passed away, and Tony Thomas. It was the TV version of like an MGM studio in their heydays when everybody came to work. And there was more people coming in and out of that lot that I, oh my God, I grew up watching you on TV, you know. I mean, you know, and I was, you know, I'm sort of fawning over people all the time. It was really a wonderful experience for me because I just adored it.
Mm. And interestingly enough, we all know Estelle Getty joined the cast later on for the last two seasons, but because they ran parallel and were both produced by the same company, Whit Thomas Harris, for the first 4 years, I think at one time or another, all of the Golden Girls were on Empty Nest.
Yeah, eventually everyone made it on the show. I mean, we're supposedly we live on the same street. So, I mean, they all eventually, somehow we did crossovers. I think I was on the Golden Girls a couple of times. And then they came over on our show once in a while. And then Estelle sort of landed there as her character from the Golden Girls, which was terrific. So that's sort of, as going back to your other previous, you know, a few minutes ago question or comment, that yeah, we're all that, like this family. That's what made it work so well.
Being this family and being there for the entire 7-year run, when Christy McNichol came back and the 1-hour finale came about in 1994, what was the last tape day like?
Well, it was emotional. It was sad. It was happy. I mean, we were happy to have Chris back. We're sad the show was coming to an end. I mean, you know, there's 300 people that are there to make you look good as an actor, and we all appreciated everybody, and there was a lot of kisses and hugs and tears, and you know, it was and then there's that, like, okay, I have no place to go tomorrow. <You know? laughs> that was a tough one. I was like, oh man, 7 years. I had a really good routine going down there for a while, and now what do I do? You know.
Well, it's also interesting, and for the younger people in the audience, I believe Empty Nest debuted in 1987. Now, cable is in its infancy. The big three networks are still the big three networks, and for the first, right, I think, 3 years, Empty Nest was really never out of the top 10. If it was, it wasn't very often. What is it like to be that known, that on that popular a television series?
As an actor, it's about as good as it gets, because I mean, you're on a hit. I actually had the same conversation with Ted Wass from Blossom, played the dad on Blossom, because he was on that same set, and we were very good friends, and we marveled at the fact that, you know, we were on TV in the last vestiges of the big three networks, and we were on one of them, and we got to experience that. You know, imagine, like, if you were an MGM star during the heyday of MGM, you know, one of those. It was kind of like that. You know, we were at the end of an era, and it was really great to be, because when you were on TV, there was NBC, ABC, and CBS, and then this little upstart Fox, which since taken off amazingly. They had the one show, Married with Children, but it was pretty darn cool, I got to tell you.
Absolutely. Now, to backtrack a little bit, David, how did you get the role on Empty Nest?
I think I got it because Paul Witt really liked me, and Brandon Tartikoff, who was in charge of NBC at the time, really liked me also. Brandon Tartikoff put me on ALF a couple of times and a whole bunch of shows. I mean, I was like in all these like weird little places that, you know, somebody couldn't make it, and he would put me on the show. He kind of like helped me off. Helped me get on to NBC. And then for me, I had done so many pilots for NBC that never saw the light of day. So here was one more that I thought, well, there's no way this is going to fly. But I consider myself the luckiest kid from El Cajon, California.
A great, great run. Now, tell us how Joe Isuzu came about.
Oh, okay. So I was doing commercials. And so I had a couple of really good successful runs at campaigns. One was back east for Atlantic Bell Telephone, but it only played in three states. But I played Joe Friday, and we shot it in black and white. We had the Dragnet theme and everything like that. That ran for 5 years. I thought, well, it won't get any better than this. And then they had this audition, and they wanted John Lovitz because he was doing, I can't remember his character's name, but he was the liar on Saturday Night Live. Well, he wanted way too much money because he's a star. So they had this thing where, where they tell you, we want this. So it was like John Lovitz's character. Well, you only have 21 seconds, and his character takes 21 seconds to come up with a lie. Right, I'm married to, Morgan Fairchild. Yeah, she's my wife. So all I did was, basically, I just smiled really big, became the smarmy guy that I really am inside, and I got the job. And so we shot two commercials, and I thought, okay, that's great, that was good, I'll go on to the next commercial. And then they called me up and said, we want to make a campaign out of it. And the weirdest part was I wasn't Joe Isuzu for the first four, five, six commercials until the director says, we got to, here, he put a name tag on me and said, Joe. And so he says, so I said in one commercial, I said, hi, I'm Joe Isuzu. And now I had a moniker, right?
Mm.
So that was a great experience.
Part of pop culture. Now, after Empty Nest had run and that was over with, you went back and did a little work as Joe Isuzu. What was that like?
That was bizarre. Because that was so long after. I think it was 2000, something like that. And the campaign had ended in 87, or at least my part of the campaign. 87, 88, after the first season of Empty Nest. And I remember I got a letter in the mail that said, service is no longer required. I said, boy, that's cold showbiz stuff right there, baby. And so then in 2000, my agent called me up and he said, they want to do the Isuzu thing again. I'm not sure. And he said, I go like, you know what? It's probably some car dealership somewhere. They just trying to get a hook and whatever. And they called me back and said, no, they want to do it again. So I said, but one of the stipulations was you can't make fun. You're not a liar anymore. And I said, well, that's what the whole character was. He was a car salesman who lies, right? That was the whole deal. So now they tried to revamp it. And I didn't understand at the time. The reason they brought me back was they were going down as a company in America.
Mm.
I mean, they were really going down. And I didn't get it until they sent me to the factory, which was in Lafayette, Indiana. And all the employees, the people who drove hours to get to this job that they really needed, you know, were so happy to see me. I felt almost responsible for making this thing work because there were so many people that needed the job, you know. So, but unfortunately, the company kind of went down. They stopped making cars. They still make their trucks, which are, you know, the things that you see on the road that says this is a big white truck, and they're carrying stuff in the back. But they no longer make cars here in the country.
The tagline, "You have my word" on it, was that written somewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was written. Yeah, that was, yeah. It was basically a great tagline. Since I told all these other lies, right, it's a great, it's got more room than the Astrodome, and it goes 300 miles an hour, and then they put all the little disclaimers at the bottom. You have my word on it.
In the last few minutes here, David, you were a part of the great cult classic Airplane. What are your memories of working on Airplane?
Well, that was my very first job. I was 29 years old. My best friend, still my best friend, Robert Hayes, was a star. Matter of fact, I just had lunch with him yesterday, Ted Stryker. And I auditioned, I think, 3 or 4 times for that part. And so I get my first job, and I'm sitting down, and they're shaving my head. And I'm sitting next to Lloyd Bridges, who's getting a haircut. And he was the coolest dude. I mean, he was really cool. I mean, everybody on that show was fantastic. It gave Leslie Nielsen a whole new career. He cracked me up. He was so funny. You know, he had this little fart machine that he would hold in his hand. He would use this thing all the time. And he goes, like, watch this, watch this. So he comes over to some cute, young, pretty extra, and he goes, "How are you doing? Leslie Nielsen, how are you?" And he had his hands tucked underneath his arms, and then he let out one of these long fart noises. And he'd go, "Oh, excuse me, I had onions for lunch." You could see this girl's eyes like widening, like waiting for whatever it was that was going to hit her.
Oh, I'll never forget. I was first, I'd been in radio a while, but we'd always wanted to have Leslie Nielsen on. And finally, I remember he said yes, he would do it, and he came on. And he let that thing go, I wasn't aware of it, on radio. And I'll tell you, that will bring an interview to a halt.
You didn't know.
No, this was 15, 17 years ago, and he let that thing go.
Gosh.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. He became so infamous for this thing, so it was almost like expected. But you didn't know.
That would
be a tape I would love to hear.
And you know what was funny? I'll tell you what's funny about that. I recently listened to that, and I never acknowledged it for obvious reasons, and neither did he. He never said a word about it.
He always had a straight face. I mean, he sold it. He sold it so well. It's like, here it comes. I'm not gonna tip the joke.
I think he said after he did it, I think all he said was, "Oh dear me," and then we were off and running, and there was never any more, acknowledgement.
Oh dear me.
Yeah. He was big time funny. Big time funny.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
David,
it's so funny. He got that whole career from Airplane, a whole different career. Instead of being the straight guy, he's the funny guy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. David, when Empty Nest ended, you just spent 7 years on a big hit television series. What kind of things did you get offered when Empty Nest ended?
I got offered first class airplane ticket to a celebrity golf tournament. I did that for quite some time. I was very good at it. It's an odd phenomena. I didn't think about having to work again because I'd always worked, and then it just sort of like dried up. So I did a few movies. I did a few TV shows afterwards, kind of guest spots. But I'm pretty much fully retired now, and enjoying my life very much here up in the beautiful state of Utah.
Oh. Now, with Empty Nest, I mean, because we know, for some reason now we know what everybody makes. And not to ask, but was the money good on Empty Nest in those days, being on a hit television series?
Well, let's put it into perspective. You know, it's all subjective. The money I was making was nowhere near the money Christie and Richard was making. But it was a lot of money for me. So, I mean, for me, that was a lot of money. So I've been very frugal. I was brought up by very frugal dust bowling parents. So I'm pretty, as long, I told my wife, I said, honey, I think we're set for life as long as I don't do anything stupid. And I think I just did. But we'll see what happens.
And what are you doing? Bees? Retired? What do you do? What hobbies? How do you spend your time?
I ski every day. And then when I'm not skiing, I go play golf.
Sounds like a good
life.
Oh.
Oh, no, this is so hard. I have to get up in the morning and make coffee, and then have breakfast, and take the dogs out, then go ski, come home, have a beer, watch golf on TV. it's kind of tough. I managed to get through the day.
I can imagine. Did you keep anything from your career, memorabilia from Empty Nest or Joe Isuzu or Airplane or anything?
I have tons of stuff. I have two mugs that Harry used every day on the set for coffee. I've got a watch with Dreyfus's picture on it. I've got the script from Airplane with the annotations, the original script. I've got, I used to have all the wardrobe from Empty Nest, but I do have the pair of shoes I wore, same pair of shoes for 7 years on this show, pair of sneakers. I have that and the leather jacket I wore in the pilot for Empty Nest.
Oh, that's, you didn't keep any of Estelle's cue cards that she autographed for you.
That would be pretty cool.
Yep.
That actually would be great.
One episode of Empty Nest I want to talk about before we leave, because it was my favorite episode, is the one where Richard Mulligan dressed up like a woman and came on to you.
Oh. We were in England.
Yes.
I said, are you a Nancy boy? I'm like, yeah, that was really strange. You know, that was a very disturbing episode. I had a nightmare about that episode shortly thereafter, where I woke up in a sweat, because in the dream, Richard Mulligan was dressed up in full kimono outfit, like a kabuki girl. And he was sitting on the edge of my bed talking to me with, you know, with the chopsticks in his hair. And then I woke up, what is that? You know, I was like, that was a weird show. And I think we were in England, right?
I think that's where it was set, yes. I think so.
Yeah. He had some sort of cousin or something. It's hard. There's a phenomenon that happens on a show like this. And I talked to Dinah about this. And it's like, we shot on Tuesday nights, and we come in for a reading on Wednesday morning. And every Wednesday morning, we come in after working for a week on that show, and we couldn't remember what the show was about.
Mm.
And I think Dinah said, we're making room in our head for the new show.
That's understandable.
We would look at each other and go like, what was the show about last night? And I go, I can't remember.
It was a funny show, and we hope for generations that it does make it to DVD or Netflix or something, because it's a funny show that people should see, always consistent, always a joy, and what a pleasure it has been to have David Leisure on today. Like I said, I think it's been about 11 years, David, so you have to come back more often. If you want a hot dog on March the 1st, just come on over. It'll be a big event.
I would love to sign a bun.
David, thank you so much. This has been a fantastic hour, and come back, please.
Thank you. Anytime. My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Hey, David Leisure, not too bad there. Tomorrow, Bill Macy and the NASCAR driver from Ohio riding in the Daytona 500 tomorrow. Where's this? Well, thank God you're here. Mike Tift, my brain. I'm like David Leisure. I can't remember what I did last hour. Who was on?
Yeah.
Ned Beatty. Ned Beatty. Coming up today, Voice of a People 4:10 and the Pastor Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker at 5. Don't tune away. Oh, my God. We're having a good time here on WWGH Radio.
GH1071.com. They discuss topics of the day and take your calls at 740-383-994. Join them.
Hi, are you looking for a church?